possibly we could select the Washington Monument, which probably represents the most ambitious work of its kind of the modern world. Two monuments to soldiers. Two monuments to the remembrance of persons who brought forth order out of chaos, created new nations, and brought states together in an important federation to be ruled over with wisdom and prudence. The next thought that we have is that nothing resembling the gardens of Semiramis remains. Yet this mysterious queen of Babylonia, whose symbolism, of course, was related to the planet Venus, suggests to us the greatest monument to heroic womanhood in the world today, the Taj Mahal at Agra. The mystery of love in stone and marble, as it was created in India, in honor of a great queen, in honor of a wonderful woman, in honor of a remarkable career and dedication, and is said to be Asia's great contribution to the concept of world womanhood, appropriately under the symbolism of Venus. Now, for Mercury, we can also have something that travels and moves and does all kinds of strange and wonderful things, and we placed under it the most massive and enduring of the ancient marbles. This marble was the Pyramid of Giza. What is the largest, vastest, most inconceivable surviving evidence of man's handicraft? It does not belong particularly to recent times, but it still survives. Therefore, it comes under our heading. And the answer, of course, is the Wall of China. This wall, she created by men, and incidentally, largely by scholars, because it represented the greatest persecution of learning the world has ever known. But this immense wall, 25 feet high, 50 feet thick, and 2,500 miles long. This is, without question, man's vastest architectural achievement. And every little distance along the wall, great towers rising, gates, and a complex of structure that stretches like ribbon over mountains and into valleys, over cliffs and into depressions. Boundary an empire, created to keep the enemy out, but like all exclusiveness, serving only to keep the friend locked in. There was no release, no achievement of this particular wall. It was a complete failure, but one of the greatest achievements in itself of the skill of human life. So vast that most Chinese living along the wall today do not believe that human beings built it. It had to have been built by divine agency. And although it was built and constructed about the time of the Christian era, there is also a note of science in it, because over one of the gates is a proclamation stating that it was built under a certain emperor, who, by the way, was the persecutor of learning, and that this emperor had caused a wall to be built around his empire, one-tenth the circumference of the earth. So that at the time it was built, 2,500 miles long, the ancients had the concept that the world was 25,000 miles in diameter, which is not very far from the fact. Now, out of the development of our own time, we have also created wonders. And the question arises in our thinking, what are the wonders which we have fashioned? Now, we have many that we can select from, but let us see whether these in any way can be regarded as paralleling psychologically the implications and inferences of the older concept. What are the great wonders of the modern world, not structure, but wonders that we have perfected, that perhaps having arisen from older sources, we have so largely and greatly transformed that they no longer bear distinct relationship to the older sources. We have the Colossus of Rhodes, for example, and we cannot make all the parallels, but we will make one or two to show the way my thinking has been on the subject. We have the Colossus of Rhodes, bound to the concept of astronomy, bound to the concept of liberty by the Statue of Liberty. And what do we have out of this? The torch held up. What does it bring to our mind in modern development? Perhaps one of the key discoveries or contributions of modern times, the electric light. Here we have the beginning of the development of a modification which was to change the entire life of the race. So the symbol of light finally comes down to us as the principle of physical illumination. The development of certain essential concepts relating to a whole variety of extensions, the power of the electric light to transform habits, practices, policies, and to make available to man a life at night, a life apart from the life of earlier man, a life which also gives to him illumined leisure if he wishes to so use it, depending on his own instinct. And from the moon, and from Ephesus, and the ancient symbols of the lunar goddess, imagination, imagio, we have perhaps another great shadow casting power of modern thinking, the motion picture. For the moon was strangely the symbol of mist and mystery, was strangely the sign of shadows and reflections, a world of things of appearance, deriving its light not from itself, but from the sovereign sun. So it was a reflector, or a secondary source of light, and perhaps suggests to us the effect of the motion picture upon the entire life of man. And then, of course, what have we to correspond to the magnitude of things? The magnitude of Zeus, of law, the Empire State Building, these things that must always be greater and bigger. And perhaps as we look at the thunderbolts in the hand of Zeus, we can be reminded of the development of our atomic and electronic sciences and arts. The rise of a great system which can, under loving and intelligent skill, become a wonderful servant of mankind, but certainly one of the stupendous achievements of modern man. Now Saturn, representing the ancient principle of mathematics and the lighthouse that guides the Tour Eiffel or Eiffel Tower, and the development of a certain concept, of bringing a certain kind of light to man, may be paralleled by a department of knowledge which has been always associated by the medieval people with the deity Saturn, and that is the invention of printing. Printing is one of the most powerful forces known to modern man, not available to the ancients. By means of printing, the world of the mind has opened as it could not in any other way be opened. It has produced the diffusion of knowledge. It has made available to the individual the inherited wisdom of his species and his kind. It is a mighty tower rising to carry upon its top the blazing symbol of enlightenment. And the use of the tower depends upon the flame at the top, and the value of printing depends upon the quality of that which is printed. For Mars, representing the mausoleum of Halicarnassus and many other parallel symbols, we can think of another very important field of research that has been open to man, and that is the development and discovery of the X-ray. Here we have a possible means of solving problems, a means as yet hazardous, a means as yet uncertain, but giving us a powerful instrument for the assistance of the human being under many conditions. And of course, X-ray can extend into other fields than that of therapy, and becomes important, directly or indirectly, in many phases of our activity. Under Venus, comes the possibility of a larger life, a possibility of bringing to the individual the beauties and wonders of the world, so that the whole earth can become a kind of hanging garden and every man is a tourist. And this is the development and advancement of our great systems of transportation. Transportation has now been elevated to the point whereby the automobile, the aeroplane, and other devices, the world becomes available and accessible to all of us. Transportation has done a great deal to deform, but also to beautify the world in which we live. It makes it possible in many cases today for every man to have his garden, to have his own world of flowers and beauty, because he is able to travel further between his business and his home. It makes it possible for him to go out and see his country or see his world. And if they ever get the signboards down, we'll see it better. We now have the whole world thinking about a one-world policy. We have selfishness, we have greed, we have intolerance with us still. But these things are passing further and further out of fashion. The individual who exhibits these tendencies is no longer respected as the outstanding citizen. What is respected now is a constructive, hoped-for understanding of mankind. Therefore, it would seem to me that this vision, supported by vast economic structure, actually receiving the major cooperation of many peoples and many levels of integration, that this organized concept of world peace is one of the wonders of the modern world. It is something long overdue, but gradually coming to be done. And by it we are divided from ancient man, who may have had the dream, but had not the ability or the perspective necessary to bring this dream into objective manifestation. We have brought the dream into the world of realities as we know them, material, intellectual realities. And we are fighting to make it work. We are struggling to bring this concept to maturity. Now we had the moon, Diana of Ephesus, music, the Vatican motion pictures. Here is the entire lunar pattern. And what have we today achieved as our great offering to the Lady of the Mysteries? I think the thing we have to offer is something that is paralleling, whether we realize it or not, the labors of world peace. We are merging into a gradual concept, which is now a birthright. The concept of interreligious tolerance. The possibility of religions meeting as such. The gradual emergence of man's instinct to comparative religion. The emerging of the instinct to recognize that other faiths have a right to exist. The moving away from the exclusiveness of a religious position to its increasing inclusiveness, as exemplified by the recent series of articles in Life magazine and many other articles being published constantly, pointing to the possibility of the faiths of men becoming a basis of unity between peoples rather than a constant source of disunities. The ancient world, Pythagoras knew this unity. Others have known it also, but today we see the actual machinery of unity moving into action, and we behold the mystery of man's greater kindliness toward religion, and with each passing year, a greater willingness to explore and examine the building of bridges between faiths and all of these principles. Have much to do with the hope of our future. And here is another wonder that has emerged from man, part of the archetypal pattern the head to come forth in the course of ages. Now our great deity Zeus, personifying Jupiter and law, tied up with the great architectural achievements, also tied into the development of atomics, brings us face to face with the great development of the concept of Zeus, namely the concept of administration. And here we have come to another tremendous step, namely constitutional democracy and universal suffrage. These things existed in small fragmentary areas in the past, but never before have we seen the concept of the rights of man developed and unfolded as in the last 300 years of our world existence. Here we have the concept of government by the people, for the people, and of the people. We have a tremendous group under a certain amount of pressure today, it is true, but still this pressure, even in itself being asserted by other groups in whose actual existence socialized principles are also present, although perhaps at the moment disfigured. But the great motion toward the right of the human being, the great motion of the political equity of peoples, the rise and recognition of the right of all men to their place in the sun, their opportunity to direct or to share in the administration of their own destinies. This tremendous concept of workable political democracy under many names, but giving to the people liberties and equalities unknown in ancient times, is also a tremendous ethical step forward. We know that the Pharos of Alexandria, under Saturn, the symbol of the Old One, mathematics, the Eiffel Tower of printing, we have all these different levels, and then we have this concept of Saturn, concept of the aged, coming forward to us in another great development that has come to us in many cases in the memory of the living, and that is the rise of the whole pattern of the security of man in his advancing years. Old age security of various kinds, endowments, insurance, and even national intervention, the gradual development of a protective economics for the old, a gradual recognition of the right of the individual to the dignities of existence, a right ignored by most of antiquity. This gradual protective mechanism, with its faults, with its mistakes, but with its great hope behind it, has emerged and is fighting its way toward gradual integration and rationalization. We have the advantage over what was the absence of our present attainment. We have yet far to go, but the gradual development of securities, security for the young, security for the unemployed, security for the aged, these things are here and they are here to stay, and they are here to grow and to develop. And they represent a tremendous thing, which in terms of the ordinary probabilities of life, is what little less than a wonder, something that is almost inconceivable in the light of ancient ways, but to us is becoming familiar and generally acceptable. Then we have under Mars various developments, symbols, developments from the ancient mausoleum of Halicarnassus, and we then have another concept, the fight through to what we know today as universal education. The power of universal education is something that is to be reckoned with. Not more than 100 or 150 years ago, the majority of human beings were born into this world with a conviction that they must remain illiterate. And while today we still have a great deal of illiteracy, more than we realize, still the struggle toward universal education The extending of the privileges of education into the most remote parts of the world. This struggle goes on, moved and fired and impelled by something within man himself. This tremendous dynamic to correct the weaknesses which he is discovering in the social structure around him. He is realizing more and more that his own security as an educated person depends upon the fact that other persons are educated. That we cannot have world peace, we cannot have world health, until ignorance in far places is overcome. We are also under tremendous pressures to determine the essential nature of education, to recognize the need for reform and change within the structure of it. But regardless of these changes that must come, and they will come also out of this same pressure within man, we have made an achievement which would have been incredible to antiquity, namely that we have advanced education until it is no longer limited to classes, that it is no longer limited to groups or levels, but that a certain amount of education in our Western way of life is now compulsory, and that the individual is destined and inevitably foreordained to have a knowledge as his common birthright, which would have been the admiration of his ancestors. Actually, in the Middle Ages, kings could not write, princes could not read, and the average person had no knowledge of even the simplest mathematical formulas. He could not even add or use the multiplication table. Thus, it is important to realize that in a short time this has been transformed. Not in the terms of 10,000 years, but in the terms of 500 years. Man has greatly and wonderfully advanced his abilities and created a concept in himself which he must live up to. And it is this group of concepts with which we are primarily concerned at this moment. Under Venus, the hanging gardens of Babylon, and the wonderful reservoirs for the watering of these gardens, comes something else, and that is the complete structure that we have today of public utilities and sanitation. Here again is something we have never known before in the history of the world. The lack of these facilities prevented the ancient world from developing cities, and it was not until Vitruvius created the aqueducts in Rome and designed the sewers that Rome could even begin to be a city. We also realize that as late as the 15th century, the average city of Europe had no sewers. That in the 17th and 18th centuries, London had no public sanitation. And up to very recently, of course, with the development of our principles of scientific knowledge, only very recently have public utilities come into existence even as a concept. But these things have advanced our way of life in numerous regards. We are no longer decimated by the bubonic plague. We are not like Europe in the 13th century, where 25 million died together in a few months, nor with Europe between the 13th and the 16th century, where in 300 years, two-thirds of European civilization died of plague. We have gradually cleared many of these problems. And the entire concept of bringing to man a knowledge involving the entire care of himself, a greater increasing scientific awareness of nutrition, of clothing, of sanitation, of hygiene, of eugenics, all of these things have come to man as a birthright in our day, but they are things totally unknown to man of long ago. A few, perhaps, brilliant individuals discovered for themselves. An occasional person may have come under strong influence and become informed. But the body of society was without these advantages, without this knowledge, and therefore subject to numerous infirmities that we do not know. Let us not forget also, of course, that we are subject to infirmities they did not know. But the great picture, the concept, of man's development of his public utilities and sanitation principles represent This concept represents a great step forward, a step forward which will mature and ripen in due course with many other activities. And under Mercury comes the seventh of these principles which we wish to bring to your attention. And this is something which is a highly controversial subject, but which in time must mature itself for our very serious consideration. And that is that in the modern world, under Mercury, we have produced the organization of labor. The organization of labor is far more important than we realize. For until man was able to socialize and integrate his working concepts, his entire cultural life had to be sacrificed to the interminable processes of work and activity. The organization of labor is something that could never have occurred before. It has become the foundation of bringing leisure, bringing protection and security to three-quarters of the people of democratic civilizations and political systems. It has made possible the gradual enlightenment and improvement of labor. It has brought labor into a recognition of leisure. It is gradually challenging labor to personal, individual self-improvement. The problem is still in a comparatively imperfect degree of development. But the power to organize, to protect the power of the individual, his earning capacities, his privileges as a human being, this power unknown to ancient man is perhaps somewhat overworked by modern man. We have gone to extremes. We have become too political, too this and too that. But the great principle of the right of the individual not to be exploited, the right of the individual to profit and share in the consequences of his own endeavors, these principles are right. And in time, these principles will find their right workings in our way of life. So here are seven great achievements which we have made. Achievements which have to do with the motions of time. These achievements, apparently, are very close as archetypal structures to the first glorification of the gods in the wonders of the ancient world. Each of these levels represents man thinking from a basic archetype, unfolding that archetype according to the skill and ability of his own consciousness, and according to the opportunities and privileges of the times in which he has lived. But each individual going through life is bound into this archetypal concept. Each person has a dominant within his own nature. Perhaps he is potentially the mathematician, perhaps the artist, perhaps the musician. But we are all living on these rays that ray out from this tremendous corona of the sun principle. Thus, each person's contribution is determined by his own focus of attainments. This contribution principle lurks within him and presses him on. If he resists it, denies it, or is unable to recognize it of his own accord, archetypal symbolism usually moves in upon him. He dreams, he has experiences. He feels pressures. He is dissatisfied. He is not in the right place. He is not doing the things he wants to do or was intended to do. And when these symbolic pressures break through him, they break through in symbols that go back to antiquity. They break through in the primordial forms of religion and philosophy. Therefore, the understanding of these forms will help him to apply and extend these symbols into their utilities, into their practical uses in his modern way of life. So each one of us is, in a way, a builder of wonders. Each one of us perhaps is attracted to one group of wonders, perhaps is attracted to one of the divisions of the ethical achievements of mankind. Perhaps we are not sympathetic with all of them. Perhaps we feel that some of them are not what they should be. We are drawn to one and find it impossible to understand another. Yet actually, within our natures, we are likewise seeking equilibrium. And one of the reasons for tension and stress in human life is this inability to commonly appreciate the good in all things. While one thing seems good and another bad to us, while we can accept certain ideas but must reject others, there is stress and tension within our own natures. We are therefore searching for this solar principle represented by leagues and assemblies and organizations by which all incompatibilities within our own consciousness can likewise be reconciled. Each individual in his own personality is searching for a league of nations, is seeking a league which will bind his notions together to form out of them a solid and unified ability to create and express. All divisions in society reflect divisions within man himself. And it is the useful and proper labor of each individual to bring together the seven powers of his own soul, represented by the seven monuments, to build these powers into a program of practical and purposeful endeavor, using these powers to improve the society around him, to bring harmony, peace, and understanding to his own soul, to enable him to dedicate his resources to the common good of his world. Until individuals make these achievements, until they make these dedications, they cannot be happy. And if they are not happy, they cannot be healthy. And all substitutes, or all methods of evasion or avoidance, which sustain merely our natural indolence, these substitutes are not adequate, nor do they bring us the security and peace of mind which we seek. Out of this archetypal pattern of our race, which is the folk soul in which we all share, have come these testimonies to the possibilities and potentials of man. We are all enabled to build upon them. We have received the past as a heritage. We must bestow the present as a legacy. And it is our wonderful privilege to build upon all these concepts and to make use of all the acquired skills of our peoples to fashion the integration of our own lives and advance the integration of others. So perhaps out of the contemplation of these matters, something useful will come. It has occurred to me that it is an interesting subject, one which suggests psychological analysis, suggests that we search more deeply in ourselves to find the ancient monuments of potential ability which we have, and upon these monuments to build new monuments, ethical, moral, and spiritual, by means of which our own integration and the happiness of our world can be advanced. If we do this, we may find that we have resources, that the ancient monuments are gone, but within ourselves the ancient foundations remain, for in every individual is the foundation upon which he can build and advance himself into the future of his own kind. And out of the past we must build into the future. And with such archetypal thinking, perhaps we can be inspired to further self-analysis. Well, time's up.